June. The June swoon. June 1st. Last night in Louisville, Nomar went 2 for 3 with a walk, a reason for some optimism. I know he's not going to solve all our problems when he comes back, but having a live righty bat won't hurt. We're playing late in Anaheim, a 10:05 start. I catch some of the pregame, Jerry, the former Angel, back where he started. But by game time, I'm so busy finishing up everything I didn't get done during the day that I miss the first couple of innings. When I tune in, it's bedtime, 11:30, and it's only the top of the third. We're up 2-1, and Colon has runners on first and second with one out. Millar singles to left, and Swaim sends Manny, but Manny decides not to go. Good thing, because the throw from Jose Guillen is a strike. Euclid steps up, and I think we're going to break the game open. But the first base ump calls an obvious check swing a strike, and then the home plate ump rings him up on a pitch well outside. Euclid swears, and Jerry says the rookie's got to be careful not to get tossed. Colon goes 3-1 on Pokey before unleashing his good stuff, and we come away with nothing. Through three, we've left 7 men on base. I'd love to stay up and see how it turns out, but it's almost midnight. It's a defeat in a way. Voluntarily leaving an interesting game in progress. I'll feel disconnected and behind until I read the score in the paper tomorrow morning. For now, I just have to trust Arroyo will hold them and that our big guys will get to Colon. June 2nd. We lost 7-6, though only a 9th-inning 2-run shot by Dauber off Troy Percival made it look that close. We had a 3-run lead at one point, but Arroyo didn't make it out of the 6th. With the score tied, Vladimir Guerrero ripped a 2-run double, and we never really threatened after that. And the Yanks beat the Orioles again, running their record against Baltimore to 1,000-0 over the last couple of years, so we're a full game back. And while the paper agrees that Nomar could join the big club as early as Tuesday against the Padres, it also says that Trotz had yet another setback with his quad and will sit out several extended spring training games. 50 games into the season, it's hard to imagine there are that many guys still stuck down in Fort Myers. The facility must be a ghost town. Lots of empty parking spots. Even while he's sitting out, Trot will take batting practice. One of the pitchers he'll be facing? Ramiro Mendoza. I get an email from Steve.
We're on the West Coast, graveyard of many great Red Sox teams, and we blew a lead last night while the Yankees were holding on to one. Also holding sole possession of first place. I think that in the steamy depths of July, we may look back on May when the Yankees kept pace and shake our heads and say, sheesh, won't anything stop them?
Hey, don't ascribe them any superpowers. That's what they're going to be saying about us. Already around the league, people are wondering how we're doing it with all these super subs. Since I missed last night's game, I make a point of staying up for tonight's, even scoring it on a Remy report sheet. Johnny's not playing. I'd heard his knee is still bothering him from the ball he fouled off it, and that had to have been a month ago. On the mound for the Angels is lefty Jared Washburn, who was Cy Young material 2 years back but hasn't thrown well since. We've got Pedro going. He said he hasn't been able to throw his curve much because of the cold weather, the grip, I suppose. So I'm discouraged in the first, when Vladimir Guerrero yokes a hanging curve over the wall and left for a 2-run shot. Don Ercillo takes this opportunity to inform us that the Yanks have come from being down 5-0 to beat the O's 6-5. I don't know who I hate more, the Yankees for being the Yankees or the O's for rolling over. Manny gets one back in the second with a solo blast to dead center, and in the third, an Ortiz sack fly brings in Bellhorn to tie the game. To a healthy, let's go Red Sox chant. But in the bottom of the inning, Guerrero puts the Angels in the lead again with a 2-run double. Neither starter has anything. The Sox chase Washburn in the fourth with 6 straight hits, scoring 5. We'd have more, but Ramon Ortiz comes on and gets Millar to bounce into an easy 6-4-3 double play. Still, we've come back to take a 7-4 lead on the road, and I'm happy I stayed up to watch this one. In the bottom of the inning, Guerrero hits a sac fly to score Benji Molina, making it 7-5. Vladdy has all 5 of their RBIs. It's midnight, past the Sox's bedtime, and their bats go the way of Cinderella's coach. The rest of the game, they managed just one two-out single. Pedro's done after David Eckstein's fourth single of the night. The former Sox prospect will go 5 for 5. The Angels' first three batters, a preposterous 12 for 13. And a four-pitch walk to Sean Figgins. I'm glassy, a little pissed off, but dull and punchy, fatalistic. Timlin comes on to face Guerrero, and ends up facing the left field fence, watching a three-run shot knock around the rocks out there. It's 8-7, and Guerrero has all 8 RBIs. He pops out of the dugout for a well-earned tip of the cap. The Angels add 2 more in the 7th, when Falk, coming in early in hopes of keeping it close, lets 2 of Timlin's runners score. Guerrero's in the middle of the rally again, knocking in his 9th run of the night. Sitting there by myself in the dark house, facing the screen, I have nothing to distract myself from the terrible baseball I'm seeing. There's no one to commiserate with, or to help absorb the loss. It's all mine. We've hit the ball well enough, and while our outfield isn't close to their cannon-arm trio of Jose Guillen, Raul Mondesi, and Vlad Guerrero, we fielded decently. But our pitching has been horrendous. All 3 pitchers we ran out there tonight got their butts whipped. By the 9th inning, as Francisco K-Rod Rodriguez strikes out David Ortiz and then Manny, I'm in a sour mood, blaming the Sox for my own impatience and irritability. The final's 10-7, the third time in a week we've given up double digits, and we came in with the league's best ERA. It's 1 o'clock, only a 3-hour game, though with all the scoring it feels like 4, 4.5. I feel crappy and blue. I feel like I've earned the day off tomorrow.
June 3rd. Boston's on the West Coast, and I hate it. We always seem to do poorly out there during the regular season, and the pennant hopes of more than one Red Sox team have been buried in places like Anaheim and Oakland. This year is looking like no exception. The Angels have now beaten us twice in a row, and in both cases we've come from behind only to blow the lead again. Youch. And when they go out there, I always feel as if the old town team, Boston Globe writer Dan Shaughnessy's term, has voyaged over the curve of the earth and clean out of sight. News travels faster than it used to, granted. I can get game highlights on NESN instead of just a bare-ass score on the morning radio. But details are still pretty thin unless you actually stay up and watch the game, as Onan was threatening to do last night. And gosh, he must have gone to bed grumpy in the wee hours if he did. What I want most of all is a box score, damn it, and there won't be one until tomorrow, by which time last night's game will already be old and cold. Or maybe Boston's West Coast swing and current 3-game losing streak are only cover stories for a deeper malaise. Later, in August and September, I'll dumbly drop my neck and accept the yoke of fan citizenship in Red Sox Nation. But in June and July, I resist a rather distasteful truth. As summer deepens, I find that instead of me gripping the baseball, apologies to Jim Boughton, the baseball is gripping me. This morning is a perfect case in point. The alarm is set for 7:30 a.m. because I don't really have to get up until 7:45. But I find myself wide awake at 6:15, staring at the ceiling, and wondering if the Red Sox managed to come back from a 4-2 deficit, which was where I left them. I'm also wondering if the Yankees, who were playing Baltimore at home, managed to win yet again. I'm thinking that the Orioles, with good hitting and fair pitching, must have managed to beat the Yanks at least once. I'm also wondering what Nomar Garciaparra's status is, and if there's any update on Trot Nixon. By 6:30, I can stand it no longer. I get out of bed, still cursing my own obsessive nature, and switch off the alarm. It will not be needed today. I go to the TV, and I've only to punch the on button. It's already on NESN. NESN is right where I left off 7 hours ago. NESN is where the electronic cyclops in my study is going to be for most of the summer, just like last summer. And the summer before. A moment later, I'm sitting there on the rug in my ratty Red Sox workout shorts, hair standing up all over my head. Your hair is excited, my wife says, when it's this way in the morning. Looking at Jamie Parker, who is, for some incomprehensible reason doing the sports today on location from Fox Woods Casino. And although she's as good-looking as ever, in her pink suit, Jamie looks as cool as peppermint ice cream, all the news is butt ugly. The Sox blew their lead and lost. The Yankees came from behind and won. The evil empire now leads the AL East by 2 games. Even Roger Clemens, the pitcher then Sox general manager Dan Duquette proclaimed all but washed up and then traded away, won last night. He's 8-0 for the Astros. The Red Sox continue their West Coast swing tomorrow night. It's way too early to liken this particular tour of duty to the Bataan Death March, although that simile has done more than cross my mind in other years. On other nightmare visits to Anaheim, Oakland, Seattle, and yes, even Kansas City, where we go next, but not too early to restate my original scripture. On the whole, I'd rather be in Foxwoods.
Francona's talking like Nomar will be back on Tuesday, and that he'll be used as a DH for a while, letting Pokey, Marky Mark, and Uke stay on the field and in the lineup. Ultimately, though, he'll have to sit someone. Pokey's the glove and the glue, Bellhorn's the table setter, but it's hard to pull Uke after how well he's played. For his .318 average and .446 on-base percentage, he's been named Mays AL Rookie of the Month. A stray stat in the paper. Since 2001, the Yankees are 44-17 against the O's. Make that 45-17, as the O's succumb once again. They're under .500 now. The problem, I think, is that the O's are basically a cheaper version of the Yanks. So-so pitching, backed by lots of free agent bats. Like the Yanks, they're designed to overwhelm mediocre clubs, a wise enough strategy in this post-expansion era, the same strategy the Yanks used in the 50s when their ace was the lackluster Whitey Ford and they feasted on the second division, but no guarantee of success in the playoffs. As the D-backs, Angels, and Marlins, and 1960 Pirates have proven, to beat a club that grossly outspends you, you have to bring a whole different style of ball. There's no way the O's can match George's payroll, so they'll always be a few bats short. We're 2.5 back for the first time all year. It's not a hole, but it will take a streak to get us back even. At the high school senior awards assembly, Caitlin's friend Ryan, who we've been giving grief about his Yankees since April, says, "Have you seen the standings?" "Hey," I say, "you guys will do fine if you only have to play the O's."
June 5th. It's time to admit it. This is the dreaded Red Sox losing streak. Worse, it's the dreaded Red Sox losing streak combined with the even more dreaded and apparently endless Yankee winning streak. No Jamie Parker on Nesson Sports Desk this morning to ease the pain. It's Saturday, and Mike Perlow is subbing. And although I tune in at 7:12 a.m. near the end of the show's 15-minute loop and during a story about the Olympic torch reaching Australia, huh? I already know the worst. Perlow is one of those late 20 or early 30-somethings who look about 14, and this morning there is no sparkle in the Perlow eye, no lift in the Perlow shoulders. We lost. I'm sure we lost. But, of course, I hang in there to be sure, and, of course, we did. The unsparkling eye does not lie. Our pitching staff is having the week from hell. Derek Lowe lost to Baltimore in the Memorial Day makeup game. Bronson Arroyo and Pedro Martinez lost to the Angels. Last night, Tim Wakefield lost to the Kansas City Royals and Jimmy Gobble, a name at least as unfortunate as that of J.J. Poots. The Yankees again won by a single run. I don't know how many one-run victories they've rung up so far this year, but it seems like a lot. And we once more got half-bucked to death as Casey put up a run here and a run there until the game was out of reach. It's the kind of slow bleed that drives managers crazy. Mark Bellhorn did not help the cause any by running into an out between third and home, killing a potential rally. I think that for serious Sox fans, this sort of losing streak is exacerbated by the fact that the Yankees aren't losing right now, combined with the sinking feeling that they will never lose again. For serious control freak fans, sigh, that would be me, it's exacerbated even more by the fact that I can't do a fucking thing about it. All I can do is stand by and watch. Oh, and two other things. One is to remind myself that we owned first place less than a week ago and are now 3 games out of it. The other is to try and find that Stephen Crane poem where the guy says he likes what he's eating because it's bitter and because it is his heart. Stop that and stay upbeat, I tell myself. This is not impossible or even that hard to do on a beautiful June morning with the grandchildren on the way. It's a long season, after all, and September is the only month where a losing streak can absolutely kill you, and only then if it's combined with the wrong team's winning streak. Besides, I have to think of Stuart, who stayed up until maybe 2 in the morning to watch one of those awful games with the Angels, where we blew the lead in the late innings. Man, I haven't even dared email him about that. As for tonight, I have my choice, the new Harry Potter movie, or the Red Sox. If my older son actually does make the scene with the grandkids, I think I'll let him decide. Who says I'm a control freak? Later. The headline of this morning's Sox story in the Lewiston Daily Sun reads, "Gobble Feasts on Sox." Hours later, while Peggy Noonan is getting all misty about the passing of Ronald Reagan on CNBC, I think, "Gobble Feasts on Sox," and I crack up all over again. When you're losing, you take your chuckles wherever you can get them.
As I'm cutting the grass, my next-door neighbor Dave waves me over to the fence. Dave's a big Bruins and Sox fan, and we have the occasional bitch fest about the sorry state of the two teams. Dave says the thinness of the roster is starting to show, that we've gone too long playing second stringers. I say we've got to find a way to protect Manny. Tech and Dauber have struggled, and Millar's been non-existent. "And where's our friend Mr. Kim?" Dave asks. "I haven't seen hide nor hair of him." I wonder where Mystery Malaska is, whether he's in Pawtucket or on the DL. In the end, I tell Dave that it's early and that we'll turn it around. But really, do we need to turn it around? Are we really stumbling that badly? Even with this second streak, we're still up there with the league's elite. It's a luxury worrying about being 3.5 back. A lot of clubs are already well out of it.
June 6th, 7:30 a.m. The Red Sox won last night. Schilling, now 7-3, God bless him, stopped the bleeding at 4 games, and the Yankees lost, so for the time being, all's well as it can be. Footnote: it's true that Smarty Jones lost to Belmont Stakes in the final 100 yards yesterday, but he can't bat cleanup or go to his left on a ground ball hit deep in the hole, so fuck him. It's funny, though, how being a fan takes over your life. Ronald Reagan died at 1 p.m. yesterday. At the time he left for that great Oval Office in the sky, he was 93, the oldest living ex-president. And I realize he would have been 7 the last time the Red Sox won the World Series. I think. That's old enough to have a rooting interest. Wonder if the Gipper was a fan. You know what old Case would have said, don't you? Right. You could look it up.
The latest Pedro worry is that he showed up at the clubhouse yesterday wearing a wrist brace on his pitching arm. When asked why he had it on, he told reporters, "Because it looks good." Lately, he hasn't been able to throw his curveball, so this just sets off a wave of speculation that something's physically wrong. We'll find out Tuesday when he's scheduled to take on David Wells and the Padres. Nomar should be back for that game. Last night in Toledo, he went 2-for-4 with a homer and a 2-run double. I expect to be on Lansdowne Street Tuesday afternoon, trying to catch one of his batting practice home runs.
5:30 p.m. This was a good afternoon for we the faithful. First, the team Nomar Garciaparra is likely to rejoin on June 8th will be 10 games over 500, thanks to today's win. Second, Lowe went 5 respectable innings, and then lucked into the win when his teammates scored 5 runs in the top of the 6th, the only inning in which they managed to score any runs. Third, and maybe most important, I finally saw signs that, yes, Derek Lowe cares. After giving up a 2-run gopher ball to KC Royals batter Mike Sweeney in the 1st, A ball that just screamed, "Hit me," commentator Sam Horn said in the post-game show. The camera caught a look of weary disgust on Lowe's face that summed up all of his feelings about what must seem a nightmare season to a big-money player in his walk year. "What have I got to do to get out of this?" that look said. Or maybe, "What have I got to do to make it stop?" Work is the answer to both questions, of course, and following the Sweeney home run, Derek Lowe worked quite hard. He's clearly got a long way to go, and at 5-5, he's not looking like the answer to any team's 2005 prayers. But at least he now looks like he's awake, and that's an improvement. Then there's Mike Timlin, who's old-time tough and has the looks to match. With his Red Sox pulled up almost to his knees and his no-nonsense low-leg kick and stride delivery, Timlin is, in my humble opinion, worth a low and a half. He came on in relief of Derek, pitching a perfect three innings before turning the ball over to Keith Falk. And if Mr. Mike wants to give all the credit to the Lord, more power to him. Oh, and by the way, did I happen to mention that Kevin Youkilis was last week's Pepsi Rookie of the Week? Yep. Yesterday he hit his second home run. Today, the Greek god of walks just walked. Hey, it's good enough for me. June 9th. I had a big day yesterday. The sixth of my Dark Tower novels, Song of Susanna, was officially published, and I was in New York to do promotion, mostly those morning radio drive-time shows, not glamorous and grueling as hell when you pile them up, but they seem to work. The original idea was to fly in from Maine on the evening of the 7th, get a night's sleep, get up early, do my thing, and fly back late the next afternoon. Instead, I rearranged things on the spur of the moment so I could go to Boston instead. The attraction wasn't so much the opening night of interleague play. This year the San Diego Padres are in Fenway for the first time, or Pedro Martinez, who has been less than stellar this year, as it was the brooded return of Nomar Garciaparra. Funny thing about that brooding, not only was Nomar not in the Red Sox lineup, he wasn't even in Boston. He was in Rhode Island, where he played six innings for the Paw Sox and went 0-3. And no one seemed sure just how everyone got so sure he was going to make his major league debut last night in the first place. As I settled into my seat on the third base line, call last night's locale halfway between Kevin Youkilis and Manny Ramirez, I couldn't even remember where I had gotten the idea. I even played with the notion of skipping the game altogether. I'm really, really glad I didn't. Last night's tilt would certainly have to go on my list of Steve's top 10 games at Fenway ever. The thing is, you never know when you're going to be reminded why you love this game, why it turns all your dials so vigorously to the right. I've been at Fenway for 3-1-0 shutouts, and the Red Sox have won all three. Wes Gardner, an otherwise forgettable Sox righty, pitched the first under a gorgeous full summer moon one night in the 80s. Roger Clemens pitched the second on a sweltering weekend afternoon in the early 90s. Pedro Martinez and Keith Falk, who worked a 1-2-3 ninth, combined on the third last night. The Pods, as they are called, as in pod people from the invasion of the body snatchers, one wonders, may be strangers to Fenway, but their starter, David Wells, knows it well, and we, the Fenway faithful, know him. Never inarticulate, Boomer has often expressed his distaste for pitching in the Beantown venue, and with good reason. Until last night, fresh off the DL, I'd never seen him pitch well there. Footnote. Today's newspapers describe Wells' latest stint on the DL only as resulting from an off-field incident. A guy I know who follows the game closely says Wells injured his wrist when he fell off a bar stool. I assume that was a joke, but given Wells' declared proclivities, one cannot be entirely sure. He made up for that in his first start as a pod person, giving up just 4 hits, all singles, and working ahead of virtually every batter. This year's Red Sox hitters are a patient bunch, and they usually wear pitchers out. Not Wells last night. Most of our guys just ended up getting in the hole 0-2 or 1-2, and slapping harmless grounders in consequence. If Wells hadn't been lifted so as not to overuse him in his return, the game might still be going on. I think he was better than Pedro over the first five, and given Pedro's post-game comments, "I want to build on this," Pedro may have thought so too. Footnote: although he was clearly pleased, at one point during his post-game comments, Pedro called it a dream game, and given the outcome, no runs and just two hits in eight innings pitched, he had every right to be. Martinez certainly got great defensive backing from his teammates, who have at times this season been decidedly, shall we say, iffy in the field. Johnny Damon made a leaping catch in center, and Mark Bellhorn made a diving, dirt-eating stop between first and second. The stop was good, but what reminded me again, forcibly, of what makes these guys pros was how quickly he was back on his feet again. Quick as a cat ain't in it, dear. If you blinked, you missed it, is more like it. But the defensive play of the night once again belonged to Pokey Reese, who has flashed divine leather all season long. I won't bother describing it, other than saying he went to his left at a perfectly absurd speed and maybe, maybe, got a helpful last-second bounce. I will tell you that I believe no other infielder except Ozzie Smith could have made the play, and relate two overheard comments from behind me, Charleston accents and all. "Do you think Nomar could play right field?" was the first. "Nomar who?" was the second. And today I complete the experience by driving out of Boston on the first bona fide day of summer, temperatures in the mid-90s, me in a Hertz rent-a-car I picked up at Logan Airport, driving up Route 1 as I have after so many games at Fenway Park since my first one in 1959. There's something just totally balls to the wall about driving north past Cappy's Liquors unhungover at 9:45 in the morning under a gunmetal sky. You've got that almost flawless two-hit, one-to-nothing win under your belt, and there are almost four more months of baseball to look forward to. I've got a cold Pepsi between my legs, the radio's turned up all the way, there's a U2 rock block going on, an Angel of Harlem is pouring out of the speakers of my little Mercury something or other. Call me a dope if you want, but I think this is as good as it gets with your clothes on. June 10th. Last night was number 5 at Fenway Park, the return of Nomar. The crowd gave him a vast roar of a standing O, and Nomar, obviously moved, saluted them right back. He took the first baseball to come his way flawlessly, starting a 6-4-3 double play. In his first at-bat, he singled smartly into left field, to the crowd's vast delight. The only problem was the Red Sox lost and the Yankees won, coming back from an early 4-0 deficit in their game with the Colorado Rockies. The Sox are now down 3.5 games. I find this out this morning, having given up on the Sox at 11 p.m., when a rain delay, it eventually clocked in at 2 hours and 50 minutes, progressed from the merely interminable to the outright absurd. The loss wasn't entirely unexpected, as the Red Sox were down a bunch when the rains came, but the fact that the Yankees won yet again came as a rather nasty shock. They are starting to look more and more like those monolithic Yankee teams from the mid to late 50s that inspired the late Douglas Wallop, a Washington Senators fan, to write, "The Year the Yankees Lost the Pennant," which became the musical Damn Yankees. A final note. In a move that may make sense to manager Terry Francona, but seems incomprehensible to lowly fans like me, the Red Sox have sent Brian Daubak down to Pawtucket. Andy Dominique started for the Sox last night at first base. After blanking the Padres for 4 innings, a provisionally rejuvenated Bronson Arroyo found himself with 2 men on and 2 out. Brian Giles hit a grounder deep in the hole, which Garcia Parra fielded, going to his right. He then made one of those patented across-the-body throws that have nailed so many surprised runners at first. Not last night. The throw was accurate enough, but a little short. The ball bounced first off the dirt, then off the heel of Dominique's glove. My opinion? Maybe Ortiz doesn't make that play, but David McCarty almost certainly does. and so does the dauber. My question? What's the guy with show experience doing in the minors when we're in a pennant race?
With all the network Thursday night shows over, it's easy to claim the good TV. I've got revisions to do and settle in. The Yanks have already won, completing their sweep of the Rockies this afternoon. So once again, we need to keep pace. Schilling's pitching, and I'm shocked when leadoff batter Sean Burrows doubles and scores in the first. Ismael Valdez, a seaworthy name if I ever heard one, throws blanks till he meets Pokey Reese in the bottom of the third. In BP, Pokey has to work to reach the wall, but Valdez finds the perfect spot up and in, and Pokey loops it into the first row of M7. The next inning, Valdez hangs a curve to Manny with David on first, and Manny goes over everything and into the parking lot. Meanwhile, Schilling's throwing 94 with authority, striking out a bunch. In the fifth, Uke's RBI double off the scoreboard chases Valdez. Cut to crazy handheld zooms of heavy-set goateed man in familiar western shirt gorging on bucket of KFC to raucous music. It's Millar in the same shirt he wore to the movie premiere. Extreme close-up of bucket with special effects of chicken pieces disappearing one by one. Going, going, Millar says. When we return, reliever Brandon Puffer intentionally walks Manny to load the bases. Nomar steps into a standing O and knocks one off the monster for a 6-1 lead. Millar follows with a double to the left center gap. Chicken man, me and Steph yell. It's 8-1 and the rest of the way is uneventful, save a woman being ejected below Don and Jerry. While the camera's not allowed to watch her, the crowd is. She must flash them, because there's a roar, and for the next 3 minutes, Don and Jerry can't stop laughing. I wonder how that looked on high definition, Jerry says. In the ninth, the momentary scare when Nomar bangs his bad foot off second base as he comes across to make a play, but he seems fine. McCarty lets us forget it by making a brilliant diving stop on a hopper down the line, reaching high to snag a bounce that should get over him. Lenny DiNardo's frozen on the mound, so the runner's safe, but it's the kind of play, after Andy Dominique last night, that makes me want to see McCarty play more.
June 11th. In his first two games back, Nomar is batting in the five hole. In last night's game, the Padres elected to intentionally walk Manny Ramirez with one out in order to face Garcia Parra with the bases loaded and the force at any base situation in effect. Number 5 rewarded this strategy, which the Padres manager would probably argue this morning made sense at the time, with Garcia Parra having been on the DL for the entire first third of the season, with a double rocketed off the left field wall. That baseball-battered monster giveth and taketh away, as Fenway fans well know. Last night it tooketh from Nomar Garcia Parra. In parks with lower walls, that ball surely would have carried out for a grand slam. Oh well, we beat the Pods 9-3. The Yankees won again, of course. They have now won 13 straight in interleague play. Damn Yankees is damn right. June 12th. Baseball's most delicious paradox. Although the game never changes, you've never seen everything. Last night's tilt between the Red Sox and the Dodgers is a perfect case in point. With two out in the top of the ninth, it looked as though the Sox were going to win their second 1-0 shutout in the same week. Derek Lowe was superb. Even better, he was lucky. He gave way to Timlin in the eighth, and Timlin gave way to Falk in the ninth, all just the way it's supposed to be. Falk got the first two batters he faced, and then Cora snuck a ground ball single past Mark Bellhorn. Still no problem, or so you'd think. That's when Olmedo's signs came up and lifted a lazy fly ball toward Manny Ramirez in left field. Signs flipped his bat in disgust. Cora, meanwhile, was motoring for all he was worth, because that's what they teach you. If the ball's in play, anything can happen. This time it did. Manny Ramirez hesitated, glanced toward the infield, saw no help there, and began to run rapidly in no particular direction. He circled, backpedaled, reached, and the ball returned gently to earth more or less behind him. Cora scored, tying the score, and costing Derek Lowe the victory in the best game he's pitched this year. David Big Poppy Ortiz eventually sent the crowd home happy in the bottom of the ninth, but what about that horrible error by Manny? How could he flub such a routine fly? Here is the Red Sox center fielder with the ominous explanation. "I was the one person closest to the action," Johnny Damon said after the game, "and I saw all these weird birds flying around. I think they definitely distracted Manny's attention when he needed it most. That really wasn't an error at all. It was a freak of nature." As one of the post-game announcers pointed out, this may have been the first use of the Alfred Hitchcock defense in a baseball game. Manny was even more succinct. "There goes my gold glove," he said.
June 13th. A worrisome article in the Sunday paper. Schill has a bone bruise on his right ankle, his push-off foot, and his start-to-start. He's been taking Marcaine shots before throwing and wears a brace on days off. What else can go wrong?
June 14th. Interleague play, my ass. Why not call it a marketing ploy, which is what it really is? It fills the stadiums, and I suppose that's a good thing. Even the somehow dingy Tropicana Dome was almost filled yesterday, as the temporarily not-so-hapless Devil Rays won for the 8th time in their last 10 games. But let's tell the truth here. Fans are paying to see uniforms they're not used to. Many of the players inside of those exotic unis, Sean Green, for instance, a Blue Jays alum who now plays for L.A., are very familiar. Or how's this for double vision? In last night's contest, an 8:05 EDT ESPN friendly start, you had Pedro Martinez starting for the Red Sox. He used to pitch for the Dodgers. And for the Dodgers, you had Hideo Nomo, who used to pitch for the Red Sox. Only before the Red Sox, he used to pitch for the Dodgers. I'm not saying life was better for the players before Curt Flood. It wasn't. But rooting was both simpler and a lot less about the uniform. One of the reasons I'm such a confirmed Tim Wakefield fan, and am sorry his last couple of starts have been disasters, is because he's been with the Sox for 10 years now and has done everything management has asked of him, starting, middle relief, closing, to stay with the Sox. Meanwhile, we won yesterday evening's game 4-1. Pedro, the one who used to be with the Dodgers and probably won't be with the Red Sox next year, got the win with a little defensive help, a lot of defensive help, actually, from Pokey Reese, who made a jaw-dropping leap to snare a line drive in the 7th inning and save at least one run. Play of the week ain't in it, dear. That was a top-10 web gem of the season. Today we have off. We ended up taking 2 of 3 from the pod people and 2 of 3 from the Dodgers, and still the Yankees mock us. Yesterday, the Padres led the Yanks 2-0 going into the bottom of the 9th and blew that lead. Led them 5-2 going into the bottom of the 12th and blew that lead as well. The Yankees ended up winning 6-5 to maintain their 3.5-game edge. I looked at that this morning and reacted not with awe, but a species of superstitious dread, because that kind of thing tends to feed on itself. The rest of the AL East, meanwhile, is bunching up behind the Red Sox in interesting fashion. Baltimore's in third and Tampa Bay's in the cellar, both to be expected. What's not to be expected, except maybe I did sorta, is that at this point, approaching the season's halfway mark, those two teams are only 2 games apart. Baltimore 11.5 out, and Tampa Bay 13.5. June 16th. When I turned in last night at 11:15, the Red Sox were down a run to Colorado 4-3. But I had a good feeling about the game, and why not? The Rockies have been horrible this year. Besides, I'd gotten a call from my publisher saying that Song of Susanna was going straight to number 1 on the New York Times bestseller list, and that's the sort of day that's supposed to end with your team winning. It's practically a national law. I wake up this morning at 6:45 and turn on Sports Desk, feeling like a kid about to open his Christmas stocking. Unfortunately, what I get in mine is a lump of coal. Red Sox lost, Yankees won. The Christing Yankees won again. I can hardly believe it. Jamie Parker is telling me these bozos now have the best record in baseball, which is no news to me. I'm thinking they must have the best record in the entire universe. The Red Sox aren't doing badly. By my calculations, we would have won the wild card spot by 2 full games had the season ended yesterday. But I am just so sick of looking at the Yankees' collective pinstriped butt in the standings each and every day. So sick of realizing that we'll still be in second place even if we sweep them when we see them later this month. There's nothing better than waking up to find your team won and the other guys lost. Conversely, there's no worse way to start the day than finding out your team lost and the other guys won. It's like taking a big swig of the orange juice straight from the carton and discovering that it's gone over. June 17th. The Red Sox are now back to full strength, or almost. Pokey Reese is day-to-day with a jammed toe, a result of that spectacular catch on the 13th. Trot Nixon returned to the lineup with a bang last night, stroking a home run to what's almost the deepest part of Coors Field. So, all's right with the world, right? Wrong. The Sox got behind early again and couldn't quite come back. Schilling lost. Television viewers were treated to the less-than-lovely sight of Father Kurt, the staff's supposed anchor, pounding the shit out of a defenseless Gatorade cooler after giving up a key two-out hit. And the Yankees won for the 730th time in their last 732 games. Consequently, we've fallen 5.5 games out of first place. These will be hard games to make up, assuming they can be made up at all. Probably they can. And what hurts the most is that the last two losses have come at the hands of the Rockies, currently Major League Baseball's worst team. But the Red Sox have a talent for making bad teams look good, I sometimes think. We have done some almighty awful franchises the favor of making them look terrific for their fans, especially during the 2 or 3 weeks after Memorial Day. For this is almost certainly the beginning of that yearly Red Sox rite known as the June Swoon. Longtime fans know it so well that they can set their calendars by it, if not their watches. It begins when the NBA Finals end. During this year's Lakers-Pistons Finals, footnote, go you Pistons, stick it to them, booyah Shaq, double booyah Kobe, the Sox were busy taking 2 out of 3 from both the Padres and the Dodgers, who are vying for the top spot in the NL West. Now that the finals are over, they are busy getting their shit handed to them by the lowly Rockies, and their lead in the wild card race, yes, even that, has melted away to a mere single game. If it is the swoon, I don't think I can bring myself to write about it, but I'll be watching it happen. Have to do it, man. It's my duty, and not because of this book, either. It's because that's the difference between being a mere fair-weather fan and being faithful. Besides, July's coming, and the Red Sox always turn it around in July. Usually, always.
I take the Fenway tour in the morning, hoping to catch BK working out. He's not. The grounds crew is doing something to the track and left. They've dug up the corner and pulled some padded panels off the wall. We can't go down to field level, a drag since I wanted to walk the track and peek in the scoreboard. We hit the press box, then the 406 club. While we're listening to the guide's spiel, I notice 2 members of our tour being escorted to the mound far below, a man and a woman. The man goes to one knee. "Kelly, will you marry me?" the scoreboard flashes. She kisses him, and the tour applauds. We cross the monster for the big view. I'm surprised by how many tours are running at once and how much activity there is. There are several school groups circling the top of the park the opposite way. Under the bleachers, a crew is setting up a catered job fair. In the right field grandstand, workmen are replacing old wooden seats. The last stop is the right field roof tables, an anticlimax, and we walk back down the ramp to Gate D, looking down on the players' lot. The guard there says BK should be in any minute. Back home, the schedule makers sneak today's game by me, It's a 3:05 start, 1:05 Mountain Time. And when I tune into Nesson at 9 o'clock, they're showing Canadian football, complete with the 55-yard line and Labatt's ads painted on the AstroTurf. I check the website. 11-0, Sox. Low threw 7 strong, getting 17 ground ball outs. Ortiz put it out of reach in the 6th with a 3-run shot. It figures, the one game I miss. June 18th. ESPN notes that Lowe's shutout was only the 2nd of the Rockies at Coors in their last 400 games. And the Yanks lost to the D-backs, so we gained ground. Francona kept Wake out of the Colorado series, citing knuckleballers' poor history there. So Wake opens against the Giants at Pac Bell, SBC if you want to be a stickler. As in his start against the Dodgers last Saturday, he's got nothing. The Giants run on him at will, and Marquise Grissom takes him deep twice for a 7-2 lead in the 4th. I'm at the beach, watching with my nephew Charlie. Why don't they take him out? Charlie asks. Because we don't have anyone else. And there's Malaska warming. With the 10:05 start and all the offense, it's late, and we don't want to keep the rest of the cottage up. My father-in-law, stumping to the bathroom in his skivvies, asks how we're doing. Ah, we're getting crushed, I say. June 19th. The local edition of the Providence Journal only stayed up as late as I did. They have the score 7-2 in the 5th, as if that helps anyone. They won, Charlie says, shrugging. The score was something like 11-8. No one can verify it, so I get on my father-in-law's laptop and hit the website. 14-9 was the final. Ortiz and Manny went back-to-back, and Millar had a pinch-hit 3-run shot over Barry Bonds, all in the top of the 5th. Son of a bitch. All we had to do was stay up another 10 minutes. Fairweather fans, Trudy says. No, I say, it's the opposite. When I watch them, they lose. I turn it off and they win.
June 20th, 7:45 a.m. Today's game against the San Francisco Giants will mark the end of interleague play for the Nantes, and I'm glad. I don't like it because I think it's a marketing stunt, but that's secondary. A New England team has no business on the West Coast. That's what I really think. Still, it should be an interesting contest. The rubber game in a 3-game series the Red Sox would dearly love to win. For one thing, it would send them home with a 500 record for the trip. For another, they go back to Boston 4.5 behind the Yankees, only 3.5 if the Dodgers can beat the Yankees again today. And Sox pitching has pretty well muzzled Barry Bonds, who strikes me, admittedly an outsider, but sometimes outsiders see with clearer eyes, as one of the game's more arrogant and conceited players. His fans in left field hang rubber chickens when Bonds is intentionally walked, but they haven't hung many in this series. Oh, and by the Ray, the Devil Ray, that is, those Tampa Bay Bad Boys have now won a franchise-best 10 straight. And you know what that makes them, don't you? Right. Hapless no more. I get an email from Stewart.
So where was Falk yesterday when Afonso came to the plate? I know our pen threw 5 Friday night, thanks, Wake, and that Williamson just got off the DL. But Francona's use of the bullpen's been a real mess lately. We've been behind a fair amount this road trip, just like the last 2. But D-Lo's 11-0 laugher should have given us a breather. Does Theo need to go and get a middle guy to replace Mendoza and Arroyo? Or are Mendoza and Kim actually going to come back and contribute? The All-Star break's 3 weeks away, and all we've gotten out of those 2 is a single quality start from BK. Meanwhile, Dauber languishes in Pawtucket, the forgotten sock. Yesterday, he jacked a foul ball out of McCoy Stadium into the middle of the football field next door. Thing must have gone 475 feet.
Where's Francona been lately? He could have cost us the game on Friday night playing Bellhorn at 3rd. Was just luck it worked out. The rubber game today should be good. Did you see the Harvard prof piece in the NY Times about how teams that pitch to Bonds instead of walking him, tensionally or un, do better than those who don't? The Giants score 0.9 runs an inning when he's walked with none on and no outs, and 0.6 an inning when he's pitched to in that situation. We pitched to him yesterday, and although I didn't see the whole game, I think he went 0-for. Oh, and by the way, how about those third-place Devil Rays?
That just ties in with the Bill James Moneyball OBP philosophy. Get men on and you get men in. And yeah, Barry was 0-for yesterday and looked asleep out and left. 10 in a row for the D-Rays. Lou must be pumped. And the O's fans must be pissed.
4 p.m. It's Father's Day, and I'm right where I belong, with a blue western Maine lake just to my left and the Red Sox ready to start on TV in front of me. I've got my book, a really excellent novel by Greg Bear called Deadlines, to read between innings, and all is okey fine by me. It's Jason Schmidt against Bronson Arroyo, a mismatch on paper, but as pointed out both on ESPN and in these pages, baseball games aren't played on paper, but inside TV sets. So we'll see. One of these things we'll see is whether or not Schmidt can strike out 10 or more. He struck out 12 Blue Jays in his last start. And whether or not Arroyo, currently 2-5, can keep the ball around the plate. 4:30 p.m. Bronson Arroyo, whose goatee, unfortunately, does make him look a bit goat-like, finds his way out of a bases-loaded jam in the first, partly by inducing Barry Bonds to pop up. Bonds continues to be an offensive zero factor in the series. By the way, you have to give it to the people who designed SBC Park. The only ugly thing about it is the name. Footnote. And maybe that giant skeletal Coke bottle in left field. 5 p.m. Arroyo settles down, but the Red Sox still don't have a hit. Kevin Millar took Schmidt deep, but Bonds snared that one, flipping it backhand into the crowd in almost the same motion. The gesture is graceful and arrogant at the same time. Watching Barry Bonds play makes me remember the late Billy Martin muttering about some rookie, "I'll take the steam out of that hot dog." Bonds is no rookie, but I think the principle is the same. 5:30 p.m. Kevin Youkilis breaks up Jason Schmidt's no-hit bid with a hard double. Arroyo fails to bunt him over. But then Giants catcher A.J. Przinsky drops strike three. It's just a little dribbler, but Przinsky forgets to throw down to first. A couple of batters later, the Sox find themselves with runners at the corners, two out, and Ortiz at the plate. Big Poppy, who leads the AL in runs batted in, stings the ball. But first baseman Damon Minor, who's even bigger than Ortiz, makes a run-saving stab, and Ortiz is out to end the inning. 6:20 p.m. After a disputed call at third base that goes against the Sox and gets Terry Francona thrown out for the first time this year, the Giants win the game 4-0. Edgardo Alfonso won it yesterday with a two-run shot off Alan Embry. Today, he gets the grand salami off Mike Timlin. On the whole, I sort of wish Señor Alfonso had stayed with the Mets. Them we don't play this year. In any case, Bronson Arroyo's best performance of the season was wasted, and the Red Sox can finally go home after a disappointing 2-4 road trip. But hey, it's Father's Day, the first day of summer, and I'm by the lake with my family. Also, there was baseball. Ain't nothing wrong with that.
June 22nd. I only have to see 3 at-bats of this one. Caitlin's birthday dinner eats up the first 6 innings. It's the bottom of the 7th when I tune in. We're up 3-1, so Schilling must have thrown well. Johnny's on 2nd, Bellhorn's on 1st, 1 out, with David Ortiz at the plate. He lines a double off the center field wall even Torrey Hunter can't get to, scoring Johnny. With 1st open, Ron Gardenhire goes by the book, intentionally walking Manny. Except now the number 5 guy isn't Tech or Dauber or Millar. It's Nomar. Reliever Joe Roa dawdles on the mound, and Nomar steps out. He steps back in. Roa delivers, and Nomar blasts one to center that bounces off the roof of the camera platform and ricochets into section 34. 8-1 Sox. And Nomar's got his first homer of the season, and only our 2nd granny. 9-2's the final, with Fulk leaving them loaded. And Theo finally picks up some middle relief help. Former Royal Curtis Laskanik, a 36-year-old righty with arm problems. He was 0-3 with an 8.04 ERA this year before KC cut him. Okay, now tell me the good news.
June 23rd. The Sox, clearly happy to be back from the West Coast, put a hurtin' on the Minnesota Twins last night. The newly returned Nomar Garciaparra hit a grand salami of his own to dead center field, and Nesson, in slavish imitation of its bigger brother, Fox Sports, even the name of the feature's the same, Sounds of the Game, decided to mic a player and pick up some ambient audio. The player they picked was the also newly returned Trot Nixon, a wise choice, since Trot, like Mike Timlin, is a long on praise Jesus and short on you ought to knock his fucking head off for that. It was a noble experiment, but a failure, I think. When Nomar's home run brought the capacity Fenway crowd to its feet, cheering at the top of its lungs, the TV audience was treated to the sound of a laconic Trot Nixon. Go, ball. Go on now. That's right. And greeting number five as he crossed the plate, these immortal words, good job, Nomi. Nomi? Well, everyone has his walk in life, or so 'tis said. The sports writers have one, the ball players another. Maybe that's the point. Footnote. So what the heck does that make me, an Onan? And we kept pace with the Yankees. That might also be the point. And the hapless no more, D-Rays, won their 12th straight. And Kevin Youkilis sat last night's out, while Mark Bellhorn did not do too much at third base. And Brian Daubach is still hitting meaningless home runs for the AAA Paw Sox. Those things might also be the point. Multiple points are, after all, a possibility. Even a probability in this increasingly complex world, but get out, ball?
Caitlin's graduation takes place on the high school's baseball field. The stage is just beyond first base, and we're sitting in shallow right. I brought a pocket radio the Pirates gave away in the early 80s with a single sneaky earbud. And as the speeches drag on, Minnesota loads the bases with no outs in the first. Lowe gets two ground balls, but again we can't turn either double play, and the Twins go up 2-0 without hitting the ball out of the infield. Later, at the graduation party at our house, I tune in to find the Twins up 4-2 in the eighth. Pokey hurt his thumb and left the game early. It's a worry because it's the same thumb that put him out nearly all of last season. The Twins hold on to win. I catch the highlights. Torrey Hunter hit a two-run shot in the fifth to put them up 4-0. We got solo shots from Trot and Bellhorn. That was it. Miraculously, the O's beat the Yanks, so we're still 4.5 back. June 24th. We're the first in gate E for today's businessman special and nab the spot in the corner, hauling in 5 balls during BP. Pokey doesn't hit, but Bill Miller's here, joking and taking grounders at third. One gets by him and rolls right to me. Thanks, Billy. I hang around the dugout and get Manny to sign my glove, and Gabe Kapler and new guy Curtis Laskanik to sign my all-purpose pearl. I notice Pokey's wearing a brace on his wrist and hand. Another bad sign. Wake looks better today. He doesn't have that scuffling first inning, and David Ortiz gives us a lead in the bottom with a towering homer down the right field line that goes over the pesky pole. I've poached a seat at the far end of the Sox dugout, right behind the camera well, and I have to look to the first base ump for a fair call. Behind him, Twins first baseman Matthew LaCroix is signaling foul. The Twins get 2 on a strikeout and passed ball, and a pair of wall ball doubles to go up 2-1. In the sixth, I snag a foul ball from Bellhorn, a two-hop chopper that clears the Nesson camera in front of me. It's the easiest play I've made all day, a chest-high backhander. So I'm in an even better mood when David Ortiz brings us back in the seventh, singling in Uke and Johnny. For some reason, Francona leaves Wake in to pitch the eighth. He gets in trouble, giving up yet another wall double. But Scott Williamson comes on to shut the Twins down. Falk throws a clean ninth, but we do nothing with our half and go to extras. Leading off the 10th, speedy Christian Guzman hits a roller far to Nomar's left. Nomar gloves it behind second, then spins to get more on his throw. It's wide. Millar lays out, but can't keep it from going in the dugout. Jose Offerman bunts Guzman over to third, giving Lou Ford the chance to knock him in with a soft sack fly. In our half, we've got David Ortiz, Manny, and Nomar. David flies to right. Manny waves at a third strike a foot outside. Nomar pops foul to the catcher, and we lose 4-3 on an unearned run. Pokey and McCarty make that play. At the very least, the throw doesn't end up in the dugout. Millar also went a very bad-looking 0-for-4. I've no idea what he's doing out there instead of McCarty after the seventh.
June 25th, 7:50 a.m. The Red Sox have won exactly one game in each of their last three series, making them 3 for their last 9. Pokey Reese is injured. The pitching staff is struggling. Our position vis-a-vis the Yankees has for a second time sunk to a season-worst 5.5 games out of first place. Only this time we've lost our lead in the wild card race. The Red Sox are currently tied with Oakland for that dubious honor. At the general store where I do my trading during the summer and fall months, people have started asking me, "What's wrong with the Red Sox?" Because I have been interviewed on NESN, I am supposed to know. I am also asked when I'm going to go on down there and whip those boys into shape. I guess I'd better do it this weekend. I'll write for a couple of hours, then throw some clothes and a fresh can of whip-ass in a bag and leave at 1 p.m. this afternoon. From the lake over here in western Maine, Fenway's a 3.5-hour drive. The weather looks murky, but what the hell? The way the Sox have been playing, a rainout would be almost as good as a win. Besides, Michael Moore's polemic, Fahrenheit 9/11, opens tonight. If all else fails, I can go see that.
The Carlos Beltran trade finally goes down. A 3-way deal that sends him to Houston and Astros closer Octavio Dotel to the A's, while the Royals pick up 3 prospects. It's a bad deal for the Sox. Dotel's a hard thrower, and the way things are going, we may end up battling Oakland for the wild card. Friday night, and we're in a local pizza place. I see the game all the way across the restaurant on a TV above the bar. I can barely make out the score, 2-0 Sox in the fifth, and Pedro's working. I figure we're in good shape since he's gotten past the first. We're talking, and when I look up again, Manny tags one to deep right. It looks out, but Bobby Abreu goes back hard and leaps at the wall, banging into it as the ball lands in his glove. He falls, hanging onto the wall with one arm. He's got it. Manny just smiles and jogs back to the dugout. I notice it's 3-0 now, so I've missed something. Trot walks, Millar singles, new pitcher. Tech singles, knocking in another run. It's 4-0, and we're paying the check. Driving home, it's still the 6th inning. Uke sends a double off the wall in left center and takes third on the throw home. 6-0. Bellhorn legs out an infield hit, scoring Uke, new pitcher. We get home and I click on Nesson, and it's still the 6th. The new pitcher has walked Ortiz, who I discover led off the inning with a solo shot, to load the bases for Manny, who has a home run and an RBI double besides being robbed. Manny slices a liner to right that carries over Abreu into the corner. It takes a hop toward a fan at the wall, who whiffs on it with both hands, knocking over his beer in the process. The ball caroms off the wall, still live, and all 3 runners come in. 10-0 Sox, and this one's done, except for a brilliant diving catch by Manny in the 7th that has Pedro pointing with both hands, giving him props. Pedro goes 7, giving up 2 hits. Curtis Laskanik throws his first inning as a Sox, and then in the bottom of the 8th, the rains come, and the ump calls it. In the Bronx, the same rain wiped out the Mets and Yanks, so we pick up a half game to make it 5 even. June 26th. It's still wet when the gates open, so there's no batting practice today. I hang around the first baseline and watch the grounds crew roll the tarp off. Mike Timlin signs and Lenny DiNardo, and just before game time, Nomar walks over. I'm in the first row and the crush is enormous. Little boys scream and plead for an autograph, Rockstar Nomar. I'm a foot away from him and think he'll actually sign the pearl I brought, but he only does a couple before scooting down about 20 feet. I poach the corner seat at the end of the camera pit, a great spot for foul balls, and am immediately rewarded by David Ortiz tossing me a warm-up ball. I get the boot early and go over and join Steve and Owen, Bronson Arroyo's pitched way better than his 2-6 record, but today he's consistently behind hitters. Uke misses a foul pop by the visitor's on-deck circle, then can't handle a throw by Johnny. He chases it down, only to gun it too high for Tech to put a tag on the runner. Jim Thome hits a monster opposite field shot. Arroyo muffs an easy grounder. Later in the same inning, Millar kicks a double play ball into right field. The Phils score 5 runs, making it 7-1, and the Phillies fans chant. The Sox are putting the leadoff man on nearly every inning, then stranding him. Late in the game, the stands are half empty. "It's not just that they're bad," Owen says. "They're boring."
June 27th. So I queued up some good CDs and made the 3.5-hour run from our little town in western Maine to Boston, pumping up for the drive into the city by playing Elvis's Baby, Let's Play House and Mystery Train at top volume about 9 times. And do I succeed in spraying my fresh can of whip-ass on the Red Sox? I do. Sort of. We lose the middle game, 9-2. The Sox commit a numbing 4 errors. But Pedro wins on Friday night, and Schilling wins on Sunday, when the Red Sox bounce back from a 3-0 deficit. Pedro's 8th win, Kurt's 10th. The former was a totally righteous 12-1 drubbing shortened by thunder and lightning in the 8th inning. The best thing about the weekend is that my youngest son came up from New York to share the Sox with me. These were his first Red Sox games of 2004, his first regular season games in 2 years. It was great to be with him, swapping the scorebook back and forth just like old times, catching up on what we've been doing. Stuart Onan joined us on Saturday, and that was good too. It made an essentially boring game fun. But there was something especially magical about just the two of us. One of the things baseball is made for, I think, is catching up with the people you used to see all the time, the ones you love and now don't see quite enough. In our family, baseball and swapping scorecards, sometimes bought from a vendor outside the park, sometimes from one in the concourse, sometimes a homemade job scrawled on a legal pad, have always been a constant. I've got a drawer with almost 30 years' worth of those things saved up, and I could tell you what they mean. But if you've got kids, you probably know what I'm talking about. When it comes to family, not all the bases you touch are on the field. The Yankees, thrifty baseball housekeepers for sure, are busily sweeping up the Mets in a Sunday day-night doubleheader, which means we'll go into our final series of the month with the Bombers 5.5 games back. Not an enviable position, but one we've been in before.
A gorgeous Sunday afternoon. It's Visor Day, and they're giving out posters with Tech and Wally promoting reading. Pokey takes BP, a reason for optimism. I'm in my favorite spot for BP, hauling in balls, when Placido Polanco rips a hooking liner our way. "Heads up," I bellow, because it's going to be a few rows into the crowd behind me. I expect it to bang into a plastic seat back like most screamers, but this one hits skin, and not the fat smack of a thigh or biceps, but a spongy, fungo-like sound, unmistakable. It nails somebody in the head. The ball ricochets at a right angle another 10 rows into the stands, and a bald guy in his late 50s who is coming down the aisle reels sideways into the seats, still holding his 2 beers. He wobbles like a fighter trying to stay upright, until people take him under the arms and sit him down. He looks dazed, mumbling that he's all right. I'm already waving to security to get a trainer out here, medical staff, somebody. Former Sox pitching coach Joe Carrigan has been pacing the wall all BP, warning kids to keep their eyes on the batters. He gets a ball for the guy and is standing there talking to me about how dangerous this place is, how Yankee Stadium's the same way down third, when Polanco stings one right at us. It skips once on the track. Joe backs off a step, and I glove it. When BP ends, I check on the ball guy. He's sitting down, surrounded by security and a couple first aid guys. On the side of his dome, he's got a purplish knot the size of a fried egg. I think he should go to a hospital. At the very least, he's got a concussion. But he's talking with them, giving them his information. He wants to stay for the game. Trudy's over at Steve's seats. She saw all the hubbub. People around her thought it might be a heart attack. She shows me that the souvenir cup makers have fixed the Schilling. He must have a good agent, she says. The pregame ceremonies pay tribute to all the middle-aged guys who took part in the Sox's pricey fantasy camp. They fill the baselines, stepping forward and doffing their caps, as Carl Bean announces their names. No one except their families is paying attention until two guys on the third baseline unfurl a messily spray-painted bedsheet that says, "Yankees suck." It gets a big hand, but in typical Fenway fashion, when the guys walk by us on their way off, someone behind me hollers, "Is that the best you could do with the sign?" June 28th. Both the Sox and Yanks wanted Freddy Garcia, but the White Sox got him for a second-string catcher and a pair of prospects. Like the A's, even if they don't take their division, they'll be in the wildcard hunt, and they've made themselves stronger. Theo's got another month to cut a deal. One more solid starter would solve a lot of problems. Jeff Suppan, who we let walk after last year, is 6-5 with a 3.75 ERA for the first-place Cards. And Tony Womack, one of our spring training invitees, is hitting 300 for them and running all over the place. Tomorrow we start a three-game set with the Yankees in the Bronx. Short of a sweep by either team, unlikely, it won't change the standings much, but it could set the tone of the All-Star break. Looking back at the first half of the season, I'd say we've played well with a banged-up club. 10 games over .500 isn't great, but it isn't bad either, given the team we're putting out there. And yet, they do seem like the same old Sox. A couple of great hitters surrounded by mediocre guys, zero defense, inconsistent pitching, and the usual June swoon. It could be 1987, or 1996, or 2001. June 29th. Both Lowe and Vasquez have thrown well lately, so the opener's an even matchup. To show how big of a game it is, Vice President Dick Cheney's crawled out of his hidey hole and is sitting in the front row. Johnny D sets the tone, leading off with a home run. The ghost of Tony Clark gets it back in the second with a two-out RBI single. To prove it wasn't a fluke, Johnny hits another out in the third, and we're up 2-1. In the bottom, Lofton leads off with a ground ball to Millar's right. He drops it, and by the time he recovers, Kenny's beaten low to the bag. Jeter singles, and Lofton scoots to third. On the first pitch, Sheffield flies deep enough to left center to tie the game. Jeter steals second easily. A-Rod singles off the third base bag, the ball popping straight up so that Bellhorn has to wait for it, and Jeter holds at second. With Matsui up, Jeter and A-Rod pull the double steal on 2-2, unforgivable with a lefty batting. On a full count, Matsui knocks a curveball that's down and in. Terrible pitch selection to any lefty, but especially this guy who cut his teeth on breaking stuff in Japan, into right. It's 4-2, and the rare weeknight sellout crowd is on its feet. In the Yanks' fourth, with one down, Lowe walks former Cardinal Miguel Cairo, who on the very next pitch steals Tech's sign for a curve and swipes second. "Does Varitek throw any runners out?" my father-in-law asks, and I have to defend him. Like Wake's knuckler, Lowe's sinker is a tough pitch to dig out. With two down, Nomar kicks a grounder from Jeter that should end the inning, and Sheffield takes Lowe out to left center for a 7-2 lead. The next inning, Pokey, muffs a double play ball, and Tony Clark goes long. It's 9-2, and all the runs have come from hired guns. Sheffield, Matsui, Clark. Lenny DiNardo is warming, and short of a miracle, this one's done. Ortiz homers, and the Yanks tack on a pair for an 11-3 final. It's hard to blame Lowe entirely when he got enough ground balls to at least keep things close. By now, I expect the occasional error by Millar, wherever you put him, and Pokey's got a splint on his thumb. But Nomar's got to do better. And with credit to Vasquez, another new hire, three runs don't cut it in Yankee Stadium. It's just one game, just one of those games, like the one against the A's or the Dodgers or the Phils. But we're 6.5 back and playing badly, and being embarrassed there annoys me even more. I email Steve. Getting beat by a horse like Matsui is one thing. Getting beat by a Balco boy and the ghost of Tony Clark is another.
June 30th. I didn't want to write this down, but after last night's crushing loss to the Yankees, I suppose I really ought to. About 5 days ago, just before my trip to Boston anyway, I discovered a nearly perfect crochet Yankees logo on the windshield of my truck. This is a true thing, I'm telling you. You're asking, do I have photographic proof? Are you crazy? What the windshield washer wouldn't take care of immediately, I got rid of with a filling station squeegee just as fast as I could. And it took a distressing amount of elbow grease. Those big woods crows shit hard. I told myself it wasn't an omen. But look at last night. Dick Cheney shows up in a Yankees hat. The Red Sox commit 3 more errors. The Yankee hitters are patient. The Red Sox hitters aren't. Derek Lowe, who has lately shown signs of his old craftiness, last night looked like an escapee from that old Spielberg film, The Goonies. Any halfway knowledgeable baseball fan will tell you that there are 3 aspects to the game. You have to be able to throw the ball, catch the ball, and hit the ball. Last night, the Red Sox did a bad job on all 3. And the Yankees have changed since April. This is Frankenteam. But there is good news, and it isn't that I stayed at a Holiday Inn Express last night. The crow shit Yankee logo is no longer on my windshield. And at midnight tonight, June is officially over. I'm expecting the swoon to be over with it. This team is just too good to keep playing as it has over the last dozen games. I hope. That's right. I hope. Because that's what Red Sox fans do.
Gloom and doom from Sean McAdam in the Providence Journal. I can't imagine how hard the Globe is riding the team. The Sox need to demonstrate some character. The Sox need to show why they have the second highest payroll in baseball. You can judge a team by the way it responds to adversity, etc. Hey, Sean, maybe you've forgotten, but we've had our adversity. And we responded by leading the division for a couple months. It's a case of what have you done for me lately, which for the beat reporter means a couple hours ago. We're 6-2 against the Yanks so far, and we've played a big chunk of the season without Nomar Trott and now Bill Miller. As long as we stay close, we can pick it up in the second half, like we did last year, and make the playoffs. And in a short series with Petey and Mr. Schill and Folk to close, we've got a shot. Tonight's Wake-Lieber matchup is in our favor, considering how Timmy's pitched in the stadium. It goes that way through 6. 2-0 Sox on a David Ortiz homer and RBI single. We hit Lieber but leave a lot of men on, while the Yanks can't touch the knuckler. In the top of the 7th, we load the bases with no outs, and Torrey goes to his middle guy, Felix Heredia. He's not a top-of-the-line pitcher, and we've got the top of the order up. With the infield drawn in, Johnny grounds to Tony Clark, who goes home to cut down the run, Kapler running for Millar. Now, with one down, our man on third is Doug Mirabelli, the slowest guy on the team. Francona must want 3 more outs from Wake because he doesn't pinch run, and Bellhorn's fly to short left does nothing. On 2-2, David Ortiz takes an outside pitch, and the ump rings him up. It's a terrible call, and Ortiz stays at the plate, taking off his helmet and batting gloves, muttering motherfucker while the ump walks away. When Ortiz takes the field, he's still jawing at him. I'm wondering where Francona is. Managers can't argue balls and strikes, but there's nothing more important, and we just got robbed. I don't care if he gets tossed. He's got to protect his players. Wake hits Sheffield with his first pitch. After A-Rod K's, Balco Boy steals second. On 3-2, Wake walks Mitsui on a borderline pitch that gets past Mirabelli. Francona goes to Williamson to get Bernie Williams, and he does on a splitter down. Posada, so typical, works the walk, loading the bases for the switch-hitting Tony Clark. Clark's 100 points better lefty. We should have Embry warm, but he's just getting up. And now Williamson's complaining of arm pain. And trainer Jim Rowe, Dave Wallace, and Francona converge on the mound. Either it's ridiculous coincidence, or Williamson is acting. It's ruled an injury, so our reliever can take as long as he wants to warm up. I think it's going to be Embry, but when we come back from commercial, it's Timlin. He gets Clark to hit a one-hopper to Ortiz, who stumbles as he bends to glove it, and the ball goes through him into right, and all I can think is, he pulled a Billy Buck. 2 runs score, and we're tied. Where's McCarty? I ask the TV. Ortiz gets a new glove, as if that was the problem. Cairo grounds out to end the inning, but they get 2 runs without a hit. Tom Gordon throws a perfect 8th against Manny, Nomar, and Trott, reaching 96 miles per hour. Lofton leads off their eighth with a grounder to the hole that Nomar backhands. He leaps, twisting, and throws. It's short and to the right field side, but well in time. Ortiz misses the pick, and it ricochets off his arm and into the stands. "Where is McCarty?" I yell. Jeter bunts Lofton over to third. Then Sheffield fouls off 7 fastballs on 0-2. Later, Eck will say, "I might think about mixing in a breaking ball there. You know, that's just me." Before pulling one past Bellhorn for a 3-2 lead. Embry comes on to face Matsui, even though Matsui's 3-for-8 lifetime against him. Make that 4-for-9, and we're down 4-2. Mo takes care of the ninth. Ironically, McCarty's the last batter, and never puts on his glove. And we lose one we should have won. The loss is on Ortiz, but also on Francona for not having his hands team out there late in a close game. You can always stick David at DH. Instead, he had the hobbling trot at DH. Obviously, that quad's still bothering him. Millar in right and Uke on the bench. His use of Timlin and Embry seemed a little wacky, and after Wake left the game, Timlin and Mirabelli had trouble communicating during Sheffield's at-bat, shaking each other off several times before the last pitch. Why not go to Tech, who usually catches Timlin? And what about the philosophy of using your closer for the most important at-bat of the game? We didn't even see Folk warming. Terrible. If yesterday's loss was embarrassing, this one's humiliating. They didn't win. We actively lost. Now Petey's got to be tough if we're going to avoid the sweep. That we're 6-3 against them is no consolation. 7.5 back.